Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
So, for example, hip replacement in Victoria varies by about $15,000 from one hospital to another.
New research reveals Australia's public hospital system is wasting more than $1.2 billion every year.
Punishment of young people in particular just does not work.
Victoria considers sentencing violent offenders as young as 14 as adults. And later today...
What that review recommended to us was that we introduce a process that is more focused on people's capacities.
The disability community raises concerns about a new national report needs assessment tool due to roll out under the NDIS. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. A new Grattan Institute report has found that Australia's public hospital system wastes around $1.2 billion annually in avoidable spending. This comes amid rising pressure on emergency departments, long surgery wait lists, and burnout staff. The report argues that smarter funding and system-wide improvements could boost patient care and reduce waste. The Wire's Maeve Groom spoke with report co-author Elizabeth Bolden.
So we took a look at the overall picture of hospital spending in Australia. This is public hospital spending. We put a lot of money into it as taxpayers. It's about $90 billion a year. So we want to make sure that we're getting the best value for every single one of those dollars. These are absolutely vital services. And we know that some people are missing out at the moment because they're stuck on waiting lists. They're not being seen on time in emergency departments. So our approach was to compare the cost of different treatments across different hospitals within the same state. So every hospital does things slightly differently. The way they organise their staff, how quickly they discharge patients, the number of automatic tests that are ordered when patients are staying in hospital. And we found that those differences add up to a big difference in how much each hospital is spending to deliver care. So for example, a hip replacement in Victoria varies by about $15,000 from one hospital to another. A caesarean section in Western Australia ranges from $12,000 more at the most expensive hospital compared to the least. And so when we added up all of those differences across the country, we think that there's about $1.2 billion of costs that could be reinvested in the system if the most expensive hospitals learned from the best in their state and were able to cut costs.
Prime Minister Albanese wrote to state and territory governments back in September urging them to rein in public spending. As a result, some of the states have reacted angrily, citing the intense pressure they are under. Is anyone right in this scenario, or does there need to be a balance between spending and easing the strain on the system?
That's right. It's a bit of column A, bit of column B in this one. Now, the states complain that the Commonwealth hasn't contributed its fair share over the past few years. And we think they're partly right on that. Since 2018, the Commonwealth has capped its funding growth, it's how much it contributes to public hospitals, at about 6.5% a year. Now, we've had periods of really high inflation, population growth over that period. So that doesn't actually cover a lot of new care and new admissions. So the state governments are right that the Commonwealth, you know, hasn't been contributing enough, and we think that needs to change. But it's also fair enough for the Commonwealth to be worried about the value it's getting for those extra dollars. One of the big findings from our report is that hospital budgeting has kind of become a sham. Every year, state governments set a budget for hospitals at the start of the year, and then at the end of every year, they bail them out. The hospitals run a deficit and more money needs to be poured into the system. So you can understand why the Commonwealth is worried that spending is growing every year. What's the assurance that we're getting great value for those dollars? So we think that there needs to be a bit of a bargain on both sides to break out of that deadlock.
What recommendations could be implemented by both the federal and state governments to fix the hospital budgets while not compromising the standard of patient care? You noted in the report that Australia could follow examples used within the UK and Canadian systems.
there's a lot that we can learn from other countries and even within Australia on ways to do care more efficiently, often even better for patients, while cutting costs. One example is hospital complications. A lot of people who go to hospital end up picking up an infection or a pressure injury, a bed sore, or some other complication. Now, that's terrible for patients. Obviously, you go to hospital to get well, not sicker, but it also adds to the cost of the stay. It often means people stay longer, they might need more treatment to treat that secondary complication. And these complications are things that some hospitals manage better than others. Some hospitals have put in place really effective programs to deal with them. And so that's one example of something that could be spread more widely. Another is learning from overseas. So in the UK, they've just done a big trial in London where doctors use AI note-taking software. And that means the doctors spend more time with patients, about 23% more time with patients, but the appointment lengths overall actually drop 8% less because there's less of that time spent on admin. So it's a win-win. So we think there's plenty of ideas around the system, but the reason they're not being spread is that these broken budgeting dynamics have kind of ruined hospitals' ability to invest in new projects like that. When they don't know how much their budget is for the whole year, it's harder for them to plan new projects, hire staff for a new initiative, and the incentive to really control costs is less when there's a bailout coming at the end of the year.
That was Elizabeth Bolden speaking to The Wire's Maeve Grew. The Victorian government's proposed adult time for violent crime could mean children as young as 14 who commit severe crimes would face sentencing as adults. Under the proposal, judges would be expected to consider community safety over age. The new proposal has been criticised by experts as punitive and short-sighted, saying real long-term solutions should be prioritised. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Dr. Marietta Martinovic, Associate Professor in Criminology and Justice at RMIT University, to hear her reaction.
I've spoken a lot about this over the last 24 hours. One thing that I can summarise it as is short-sighted. And what I mean by that, it's really trying to appease the pressure from the public who are feeling quite unsafe and scared and fearful for good reasons.
What other methods should be considered rather than potentially putting children in prison for up to 20 years?
So decades and decades of research in Australia and around the Western world all show the same thing. And they all show that punishment of young people in particular just does not work. And what works is prevention in the first place and early intervention, diversion. So I think what we must talk about and mustn't forget to talk about is there are these common threads that kids who get trouble in the law all have. And they're all connected with poverty, homelessness, violence and abuse, health and mental health issues, disabilities, learning problems, dropping out of school, and for many First Nations peoples and migrant families, it's also systemic racism and intergenerational trauma. So we're talking about people who have disadvantages from birth, and to then put these people in prison instead of to actually deal with some of basic human needs, such as providing a safe home, food, clothes, healthcare, school support, we are doing completely the opposite and further failing these people.
Queensland and a few other states have implemented a very similar law and have reported lower crime rates. Does this mean it's been effective, or, like you said before, is this a short-term strategy that praises incarceration over any sort of rehabilitation or prevention?
Look, in the short term, it's quite possible that the crime rates drop, and that's what seems to have happened in Queensland. But I absolutely am worried about what's to come, number one. And number two, what kind of young people are going to we be producing as a society? I think when you see and hear of these horrific offences, I think we should all ask ourselves, how did these people get to this point? And what services have intervened or not intervened and dealt with these issues much earlier on?
How do we mitigate the actual drivers of crime while also committing to serving community safety?
I think it's a balance. like I said, it would be stupid to say, well, everything's working beautifully at the moment in terms of laws and services that we provide. Well, it isn't, because we can see that there is a surge in crime. We can see that, like I said before, there's real actual fear that people are feeling out there, and governments have to act or be responsive to that. And I completely understand that. But then at the same time, what I'm feeling is there needs to be some kind of a redesign of the services that are available to help vulnerable children and their families so that they can find a way forward. So there are programs that work, and they all seem to be culturally specific. They all seem to be trauma-informed. They all seem to be long-term solutions. And it's really about that early intervention and finding what works. Peer mentoring seems to be a really good way forward for young people in Victoria, at least, and be providing really good results. So I think it's about really looking outside of that punitive retribution-based urge and really thinking about what actually works and investing our money and resources there.
That was Dr. Marietta Martonovic from RMIT University speaking to the YSM Giorgio. The disability community has raised concerns about a new national support needs assessment tool set to be rolled out mid-2026 under the NDIS. The tool, called Instrument for Clarification and Assessment of Support Needs, is designed to give participants more choice in how their assessment is conducted and to provide a more consistent experience across Australia, according to the NDIS Minister Jenny Allister. However, many in the disability community remain sceptical, warning that the tool risks becoming a one-size-fits-all approach that fails to capture complex and diverse needs. Powered Media's Emma Myers spoke with Jenny McAllister, Minister for NDIS.
The purpose of introducing the new process for assessing people's support needs really arises from what we heard during the independent review into the NDIS. And what many people said through that review's work was that the existing process is uncertain, lacks transparency, and produces different outcomes for different people that don't always seem fair. And what that review recommended to us was that we introduce a process that is more focused on people's capacities, more predictable, and less dependent on the ability of the individual participant to obtain medical reports or advice. And so the new process is essentially built around a questionnaire that's been in use in other settings for a long time. It's an Australian-designed questionnaire, and we've partnered with the Centre for Disability Studies at Sydney University. We'll set up a conversation between the participant and the planner to establish support needs.
And what do you say to the criticisms against the length of time of the assessment? There's been concerns around the 3-hour block of the assessment period. What do you say to that? Because it's quite difficult for the average person to sit in a 3-hour meeting.
When I came into the portfolio, the disability community was asking for more time to work through implementation. We have deferred commencement of the new framework planning process until next year. That is specifically so we can work through these kinds of practical issues with the community. The conversation roughly is estimated to be a 3-hour conversation. I think we want to hear from people with disability, representative organisations, about how that will be best organised for them. I would emphasise that our purpose is really to make sure that the planning experience is a positive one for people and one that is focused on people's strengths. We think a conversational approach is the right way, and we're open to a discussion about the specifics of exactly how it's implemented.
And when will the government formally respond to the full list of recommendations made by the independent review into the NDIS, specifically regarding foundational support?
This is and was an incredibly important piece of work. The NDIS is more than 10 years old. Of course, we need to look at it and assess the extent to which it's meeting its policy objectives and meeting the needs of people with disability. The review heard from thousands of people. It was a really comprehensive listening exercise. I can tell you as minister that I consult it at least once a fortnight and probably more regularly. We are implementing many aspects of the recommendations. It's a very wide-ranging blueprint for change, and we're moving through it in a step-by-step way.
What about the intergovernmental issues regarding the scope and the cost-sharing arrangements of foundational supports? Are you coming to an agreement or an understanding that who will take on that role? What's happening in that space?
So back in 2023, the states and territories and the Commonwealth all agreed that we would work together on establishing foundational supports, and that we would start with the foundational supports that would be available for children. Minister Butler, a couple of months ago now, gave a speech, a significant speech at the press gallery, where he talked a bit about some of the levers that the Commonwealth could use to contribute to the supports that would be available for children. He talked a bit about some of the examples he provided that we would be willing to consider would be using the Medicare system, for example, to provide assistance to children and their families. Our goal is really to make sure that families with young children who are experiencing developmental challenges are able to access assistance in a timely way and in places that make sense to them.
That was Minister for NDIS Jenny McAllister speaking to the Powered Media's Emma Myers. New research found out 6 out of 7 South Korean students misinterpret the beach safety signage. The research conducted by Monash University and Life Saving Victoria surveyed more than 150 South Korean university students, and only 14% of them understood the yellow and red safety flags correctly. Very vague terms in English and lack of understanding in beach safety are some of the reasons of this high misinterpretation. The wise Eduardo Jordan started asking drowning prevention researcher at Monash University, Dr. Masaki Shibata, to explain more about the research.
This study is actually the continuous study of my previous work on the signage perceptions among international visitors. So we found that a lot of international visitors misunderstood beach safety signs. So the last year we focused on Japanese students, and then this year we focused on South Korean students because they are considered as a really high risk migrants here for the drownings. But what's different from the previous study is that we also tested various different signs denoting no swimming and also red colored signs and comparing to yellow signs.
What are some of the recent 6 in 7 South Korean students misinterpret beach safety signs is so high?
So basically, that only 14% of South Korean students that participated in this study understood red and yellow flags as a safety zone. However, over 70% of them actually saw them as indicating danger zone. So it is kind of opposite to what we're supposed to indicate. So that's one finding. And also, we tested other signage terms such as shore dam, shore break, and also blue bottle, submerged object. Those signs are also quite, you know, widely used at even popular beaches such as Bondi Beach. But unfortunately, almost none really understood what they meant.
Now, what would be the first step to start reducing the lack of beach knowledge across this sector?
So this question is actually quite complicated. I've been actually talking about this quite a bit because I think South Life Saving Australia and Life Saving Victoria, they work really hard to basically, you know, deliver the safety message. But at the same time, this study shows there are lots of different culture and different cultural perspectives. And for example, this study shows a slightly difference between Japanese and Korean as well. So Japanese people, they understood the Japanese term of rip currents much more than Korean translation of Riptide. So there are all cultural differences. I think very, very first step we have to do is to basically collaborate with those foreign consulate general. For example, I actually directly contacted to Japanese consulate general this year based on my study published last year. And then I collaborated and revised their safety message so we can actually deliver proper message to Japanese people, because Japanese consulate general, they are the one who actually meet Japanese people, taking care of Japanese visitors, right? And the reason I said this area is very complicated is that I've been also giving a lot of beach safety workshops to international students. I visited a couple of universities and including Monash University. But what I actually found that although we are giving or delivering the message, but if you're not interested, you're not going to listen. If you don't think that you are high risk, what's the point they are actually listening to your safety message? That's why the delivery of the safety message is quite difficult. So we actually about to publish another work. We developed English exercise material, particularly for IELTS, because a lot of migrants are interested in IELTS rather than beach safety. A lot of migrants actually have to get a good score in IELTS than learning beach safety here. So that's why we actually incorporating the beach safety information into the IELTS practice material and then ask them to use it to study English. But we also tested how much they improve their beach safety knowledge.
Now, what are the recommendations the report provided to improve the literacy of beach safety with South Korean students?
In terms of beach safety signs, yes, this study shows that South Koreans do not understand the signage terms. Although they have experience in studying English, they are, in fact, they're university students, so they're good, and they would have like probably 69 years of learning English. But at the same time, previous work shows that domestic students, or let's say Australians, do not understand some of the terms either. So like, for example, shore dump. A lot of Australian people didn't know what it is. So at the moment, so we were using the English language that the native speaker potentially don't understand. And then we would try to translate those language and then it's not actually translating properly. For example, if you put the shore break into Google Translate, it comes out the shore relaxation in Korean. And if you put shore dump, that actually comes out to replace to put the rubbish on the shore in Chinese in Google Translate.
Dr. Masaki Shibata from Monash University speaking there with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. A new report from Salmon Tasmania says families are buying more salmon than ever before. But environmental groups say the industry's messaging glosses over serious issues, including a major mass salmon die-off in March and concerns about antibiotics entering waterways. The Wire's Roche V spoke with Alistair Allen, marine campaigner at Bob Brown Foundation.
The Salmon Tasmania suffered what can only be described as a catastrophic summer last year with a mass mortality in which millions of their own fish died. And the Australian public was alerted to the cruelty and the suffering and the huge environmental impact of industrial salmon farms in Tasmania. And so I think the public has now woken up and is starting to see the true cost of Tasmanian farmed salmon.
The response to the salmon crisis are antibiotics. Are you confident in this new antibiotic treatment practice?
The response to the disease that is that was so devastating last year has to be used huge quantities of antibiotics on these farmed salmon. And that's not to make them healthy and better, that's just to keep them alive long enough before they get killed. The new antibiotic that has been approved for this summer is very controversial. It's called flufenicol, and it has been used in Chile and salmon farms for a long time and has had big impacts on the marine environment. We are seeing here in Tasmania now that the government is recommending that people, if they're concerned about antibiotics, shouldn't fish within 3 kilometres of a fish farm that is being treated, and that's because there can be antibiotics in the wild fish. The fact that they can dump such large quantities in public waterways and let it spread 3 kilometres or maybe even more, we don't know, in public waterways is outrageous.
Do you think consumers are aware of the new antibiotic treatment practices, and should there be more education?
As a consumer, you actually would struggle. And in fact, it's really quite hard to know what is in your salmon and where it comes from. For example, salmon from Macquarie Harbour in the west coast of Tasmania is involved with pushing a species to the edge of extinction. But as a consumer, there's no way of knowing that. The same goes for antibiotic use and all the other synthetic dyes and colourings and chemicals that go into this product. As a consumer, there's no way of knowing just how many chemicals have gone into your fish and just how many antibiotics have gone in. And I think it should be right on the front of the label. I think people have a right to know what was used on this fish and what chemicals it has in it. So, yes, I think much further education can be done. But I think supermarkets, both Woolworths, Coles, the big people who are selling this product, have a duty to their customers to make them informed of what's in the product.
What are the impacts of industrial farm salmon?
The impacts of industrial farm salmon are wide-ranging, and we're not alone in Australia, in Tasmania. Wherever industrial salmon farms are around the world, whether that be Chile, Norway, Scotland, Iceland, they have the same environmental impacts. And that's because, if you can imagine, there's up to 100,000 fish at a time in a pen, and all their waste and all the nitrogen and all the extra nutrients from those fish is released into the water.
That was marine campaigner at Bob Brown Foundation, Alistair Allen, speaking to The Wire's Rosh V. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from stations across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headline across your community and Indigenous radio, at the same time on your local station. Check out all of our week's stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on social media. Just search The Wire Radio, all one word, on X, or on Facebook and Instagram at thewire-independent current affairs on radio around Australia. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the land where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakut. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time with more stories on The Wire Weekly.